The Big E Sports Show with host Elissa Walker-Campbell just got bigger. Featuring former defensive star and three-time national champion at Nebraska and NFL player Jason Peter. Jason Peter under the helmet. With Jason Peter on the Big E Sports Show with host Elissa Walker-Campbell.
It is a big weekend in golf, and thank you so much for making a point to be with us on our show as we completely turn our focus on the 2011 British Open at Royal St. George's. And although our next guest, he is a former NFL Carolina Panther and a college standout at the University of Nebraska, Jason Peter is without question a longtime golf enthusiast, has a passion for the sport, and is gearing up for his celebrity golf tournament coming up in the month of October with the great Larry the Cable Guy. Welcome back, Jason. It's great to have you with us.
Great to be here, E. How's everything going down there?
It's going great. It is hot down here in Texas, but we have got so many topics to discuss. It kind of, sports-wise, it seems like it's a slow time of year, July heading into August, but this is a time of year that you certainly look forward to, the British Open. What do you look forward to the most when we talk about this tournament?
Well, I think, you know, and this is something, I mean, other than it being one of the majors in golf, I think lately it's become something, you know, there's so much made of, I think, the European dominance lately. And I know for this year, I especially was looking to see if these Americans were going to kind of buck up and go over there and, you know, put an end to this whole European dominance. I mean, you know, it seems that since Tiger's downfall, you know, Phil has been, he's been there, but, you know, Phil hasn't been dominant. And it just seems like there's this whole new crop of youngins that are coming up from Europe, you know, combined with some veterans, and they really kind of have a strong arm to the entire PGA. You know, with McIlroy, I think, winning the U.S. Open, it was something for me to see that with all of this talk about the lack of toughness from the U.S., are we going to go over there, and is somebody going to step up and win on their soil? And that's the thing that I'm waiting to see.
And that is one of the biggest question marks going into the British Open. You know, would an American be able to walk away with the trophy? But at the forefront of the conversation, just leading up to it, has been, as the guy you're talking about, Rory McIlroy. I mean, he's got flair, charisma, you know, that youthful exuberance, and he is idolized by the public. Do you have a love affair with this guy, too? I mean, he is an exciting player to watch.
Yep, I actually do. I like him. You know, I'm not gaga goo-goo over him just yet. But the way he handles himself after the Masters, you listened or you watched his interview and you said, this kid's going to be fine. This kid is going to win. And when he does and he starts that snowball, this thing, it could be big by the time it finally stops. And it didn't take him long till he had his first major under his belt. And, you know, he drew a little controversy, I guess, with kind of packing his bags after the U.S. Open and not playing any golf, at least no tournaments until the British Open. I know he did something similar prior to the U.S. where he didn't play in many golf tournaments up until the U.S. Open, so he goes out and he wins, and I can understand why maybe you want to try something similar like that again before another major, but, you know, you're 21, 22 years old, you know, young, you're at an age where you can stay up until 4 o'clock in the morning and you're ready to roll at 7 a.m. You know, your body doesn't hurt like it's gonna when it's, you know, 40, 45 and older. So, you know, I know there were some people expecting him to continue to play and to enter, you know, a tournament prior to this British. But look, he's a professional. He has coaches. He has people around him that help him make decisions, and that's what he went with. So, look, if he wins, it's going to be a genius move, and I imagine it's going to be something that he'll continue to do in the future. If he loses, he opens the door for a lot of criticism.
Well, his rise to prominence, when you talk about Rory McIlroy, it has been fast and furious, and he really does give us a glimpse of the future of, you know, what it's all about. I mean, already, as you had just talked about, winning the U.S. Open, he started to make history. But I did find it surprising, the fact that he took 3 weeks off after winning the U.S. Open and then entering into the British, because you know the game of golf, Jason. You play it all the time. I mean, you've got to keep that timing, that tempo, and the momentum going. Now, let's talk a little bit about in regards to the course. It is not one of the favorites that we hear from many of the players, because you're teeing up the ball in 30-mile-an-hour winds, and it certainly is very, very difficult and presents its challenges, doesn't it?
Yeah, there was some talk about the moving some of the tee boxes up because the weather was so bad the past few days, but I think they kind of stuck with the game plan there. You know, this is something that I think when complaining, I think you tend to hear it sometimes maybe from the Americans, and you know, I think a lot of the European players, this is the type of weather that they grow up playing in. You know, I think that's one of the reasons I think a lot of people think that the Europeans maybe are kind of, you know, ahead of the Americans right now, is that they're tougher golfers. They grow up hitting the ball in, you know, 40-50 mile an hour wind, where if you have those types of conditions over here in the U.S., those golfers are saying, well, you know, let's go inside and you know, we'll check the weather for tomorrow. I don't know how many of those guys are going out and playing in the rain and hitting the ball in those types of conditions. But I also think there's more than just the type of weather conditions. I think, you know, you look at the kind of the way that families raise their kids over there, and you hear stories, and it's usually the stories about the stars, the guys that have the most success. But, you know, David Beckham, a kid that I believe was out of the house, out of his family's house when he was, you know, 11, 12 years old, because he was off playing for a club team. And I think that's probably something that Europeans do a lot. I know my father, who ultimately was in the restaurant business for 30-some years, and it was certainly a different time back then than it is now, but he was out of the house when he was 11 years old.
Yes.
And he was working in butcher shops for room and board. He was doing apprenticeships. So you learned a trade back then, but, you know, I think it's kind of that same mentality now applied towards sports. And I think that's a big reason why a lot of people, when they talk about the struggle for American soccer here, It's that, you know, you're trying to compare, or you're trying to compete with a country or countries that send their kids off when they're 11 years old. You know, the parents are standing there at the door saying, good luck, son, and they're off, and they're sent off to try to perfect this sport or trade, whatever it may be. And while over here in the U.S., you know, we're enjoying high school and the parties that come along with it and the victory parties, and then you're off to college, which is an even bigger party, and you know, that's a lot of time right there. That's, you know, 7-8 years that these European kids have a head start against the Americans.
Well, and you know, I even think of in women's tennis, you know, Maria Sharapova. I mean, she left home, what, at 13 years old, and I believe came over to Florida to train. And I don't know, I'm guilty as a mother of two sons, being the helicopter parent. I cannot even imagine. I mean, I want them to pursue, you know, their dreams, and obviously help them as much as possible, but I'm going to hang on for dear life as long as I got them.
Absolutely. I think I'm going to be the same way. The time flies as is. I couldn't imagine having to let them go at 11. I think, you know, sometimes I think that whole mentality can work against you as well, too, because there's certainly a element of burning yourself out. And when you're sending a kid off at 11 years old, yeah, he may tell you and he may look you in the face and say, I love this sport. This is what I want to do. But, you know, lots of times they're just wanting to please their parents. And lots of times, you know, they're 11 years old and they don't know how to answer the question. They don't have enough experience to know what's going to happen when this becomes their life. But, you know, now it's a different day. And, you know, I know for me, you know, football, it was something that I started late, thank God, because there was an element where I could feel myself starting to get burnt out. And, you know, but that's a sport also where you're in full pads, during the week and you're practicing, you're having to hit into each other and, you know, fingers hurt and knees hurt and everything hurts. You know, you can't really say the same for golf. Not to say that the same type of commitment isn't needed to succeed, but there's not that physical aspect of it that, you know, your body can really tear on you as much.
Jason Peter is with us this weekend on the Big E Sports Show. We want to direct you to our radio website. That is eradiosports.com. You can listen to our entire interview on our e-podcast page. And Jason, this weekend, we're going to hit on a number of subjects. Of course, big headlines in the NFL this past week with the Steelers All-Pro James Harrison. All I can say is, what a knucklehead. I mean, completely blasting the commissioner, Roger Goodell, and made disparaging remarks about his own teammates. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's shocking. It really is, because it always seems like the guys that you want to root for, they end up doing something stupid and saying something stupid. And James Harrison, in my eyes, you know, I'm not someone who lives in Pittsburgh. I don't know exactly the type of guy this is, but all I see on Sundays is here's a guy who, you know, he's not 6'5". He's a guy who's maybe 6 feet, you know, not a first-round draft pick coming out of college. He worked hard to get where he is today. And he had, when you're talking about the NFL, he had a lot of cards stacked against him. And he just kind of looked like that blue-collar type guy who was going to go out and he was going to work for everything that he got. And as far as on the field, I think that's probably fair to say, but then you come out and you call the commissioner, who in my eyes, and I don't know everything, but he seems to be a good guy. He seems to be a guy that kind of cares about the athletes. You know, I don't know if it's all for show, but I know Paul Tagliabue wasn't hugging, you know, the first rounders as they came out onto the stage to hold up their jersey on draft night.
Right.
And, you know, maybe it's all planned. Maybe that's something that Goodell has and his team worked together and they figured something out and this was all mapped out. But whatever the case, he seems to be a guy that is meeting regularly with guys that have been in trouble, and not just that one-time meeting. It seems like he builds relationships with, you know, the Michael Vicks and guys like that who do have a lot of controversy surrounding them. But, you know, you come out and you call the guy a stupid, a puppet, a dictator, you know, that if he was on fire and you had to urinate to put the fire out, you wouldn't do it. I mean, where is this coming from? He acts like Goodell has insulted his mother and you know, done something to his sister. I mean, it's the amount of hatred. I could only imagine the way he feels, you know, about the offensive tackles that he plays against on Sundays. No wonder the guy is so dominating. I mean, you got to have a light switch. As tough as it is when you walk off that field, you can't really carry that same mentality with you.
Well, he sounds like an individual, too, that just, you know, has some real issues at heart that needs to be addressed. And unfortunately, the team president, Art Rooney, he's not going to be able to address this situation until the labor situation is resolved.
Yeah. I mean, you got him that not only picking fights with the commissioner, but now you've taken some shots at
your teammates.
Some of your players. Teammates. I mean, Roethlisberger, and you know, for throwing a pick in the Super Bowl, and Rashard Mendenhall. As much as probably Rashard Mendenhall maybe deserves somebody to give him a hard time after the comments that he made, you know, surrounding the whole Bin Laden thing. But you know, you're throwing him under the bus, calling him a fumble machine. So I don't know. I mean, it seems like there's some sort of deep-seated issue that, you know, this guy maybe needs to get into some therapy, because life's not that bad. I mean, he's, you know, he signed a 6-year deal for a little over $50 million a year or so ago. So how bad is life, really? I mean, you're probably sitting in a nice suburb of Pittsburgh, and I know my agent used to be in Pittsburgh, and we flew in to play the Steelers, and we would have Christmas dinner. It was one of those Christmas day games or something like that. And so I've been in the suburbs of Pittsburgh. There are some nice areas. I'm sure James Harrison is not living in a place where there's bars on the window. I'm sure there's a nice swimming pool in his backyard. How bad is life that you are coming out and you're calling the commissioner of your work? You're calling him a fool and a dictator, and you know, you wouldn't save him if your life depended on it. I mean, come on.
You know, and poor Art Rooney, the team president. I mean, what a PR nightmare. You had just talked about Rashard Mendenhall, but then, of course, you know, all the comments, the disparaging comments that James Harrison has said. I mean, they've got to get these guys in and get their team under control at some point. Hey, let's move forward. Let's talk now about the lockout. Obviously, there were some discussions this week. Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, Drew Brees. They said this is the time to end the lockout. You're talking about three of the top quarterbacks within the league. Are we getting closer, you think, to getting things settled?
Well, that's what we're hearing, is that they're getting closer. I seriously doubt that they would let this thing trickle on into the regular season. I mean, we're still at a point now where, we're kind of middle of July. You know, you still have time to get in the training camp, have a full training camp. You know, have a couple preseason games if you want. And, you know, I think they're also looking at it like that, that here we have four preseason games. You know, if we want to squeeze the players a little bit and let this thing maybe run into what would have been the start of training camp, we can always cancel at least two of those preseason games to make sure that, you know, they're still having two games prior to the regular season start. There will still be a quality football season. Yeah, they've missed a lot with the mini camps, but, I mean, let's be realistic. Everything is done in training camp. As long as they have training camp, they'll be fine. You know, there's certainly a lot of mental stuff. I think the areas or the teams, the coaches, the players that have been hurt the most are the teams that have the new coaching staff or the teams that, you know, are relying on a new quarterback. Those are the teams that will, I think, probably struggle the most out of anybody this upcoming year. But, yeah, I think they're getting close. They've got to be. If they're not, then both sides need to fire, I think, their lead attorneys, because it's an absolute shame that there is so much money here on the table for both sides. And, yeah, I know both sides want to get a good deal, and both sides want to probably come out feeling like they won. But, you know, come on. It's $9 billion here. I'm sure we can get this thing worked out so everybody's happy.
Jason, you know, and I have to wonder, too, having an abbreviated season, you know, whether it's with training camp or preseason, what do you think some of the residual effects will be? I mean, are we talking that there's going to be a lot more injuries that perhaps we would see during the season? I mean, how much does the preseason prepare you? You've gone through that. How much does that prepare you for the real season when it rolls around?
Well, I think that certainly with the players and their health, you can't go from hanging out on the street to going and playing live NFL football. There has to be a break-in period. You have to let your body get used to it, get used to the pounding, get on a level where it knows how to recover. You know, there's a lot of muscle memory in your body. I mean, all muscles are kind of made
yes.
up like that, and it's no different for these NFL players and recovering from some of those impacts that they have. But, yeah, I think the season will go on. I think there'll still be a high level of play out there. I think as long as they can get a few weeks of training camp in, and I would imagine that they're going to get a full training camp in. I mean, most teams, I think on average, are there for 4 weeks. You know, some teams stay for five. Some teams break camp after three. So if they get about 3.5, 4 weeks camp, I think they're fine.
Okay, my other thing is, you know, we talk about the players, the owners, perhaps, you know, returning, getting things negotiated and worked out. But what about in regards, this hits home for you, for the retired NFL players? I mean, there's got to be improvements in regards to benefits for post-football life.
Yeah. The area that gets the most talk, I think, when you're talking about the retired guys are the old-timers. And it's shocking when you hear how much these guys, their pensions for, you know, guys that played 10 years in the league or guys that were Hall of Famers, and the NFL is paying them $200-$300 a month for their pensions. And I was fortunate. I came along, you know, I think 1993 it was when they really upped, I think, the benefits and everything for the retired guys. But, you know, that's area number one. Even as a guy myself who would certainly like as much as I could get from the league, I know that those are the guys that you have to circle and say, we need to get this fixed first. So once they take care of that, yeah, certainly I think, you know, the benefits for the amount of money that everybody's making. I don't think it would be ridiculous to ask, you know, to up, I think, the amount of money that someone, you know, like myself who, you know, not to say that my impact on the game was as great as some of these other guys, but, you know, it was the injuries ultimately that forced me out of the game, and not necessarily it's more about the rush that they have on you to get back out on the field. With, you know, sometimes I think guys probably could play a lot longer if there wasn't such a rush to put them back out on the field. And let's face it, I was a first-round draft pick. I was the 14th pick. There's pressure from that coach.
Sure.
There's pressure from the general manager up to the owner to make sure that the guys that they're paying the money to or the guy that they drafted first, that he's out there on that field. Fans want to see that. And, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm a football player. I love to play football. I wanted to be out on that field, but, you know, it's like telling that 17-year-old kid you can't do something or that he's wrong. Ultimately, he thinks that he's right. In his head, he thinks that he's right. And that's the way that I thought, that, you know, I need to be out on that field. I don't need to rest. I don't need to recover. I need to go play football. But, you know, in the end, that mentality from both sides, you know, the team pushing you and the player, you know, wanting to go because he wants to prove to everybody that he can play and that he's worth it. Ultimately, I think it ends up costing a lot of guys years off of their career.
Jason, let me jump in here because, you know, there are, without question, as you're talking about, there are injustices with the NFL retirement system. I mean, you're talking about guys that have helped build the league and they have given so much to make it all happen. But how do you go about, and I'm not sure you're going to have an answer for this, but how do you compensate former players without putting them on a permanent stipend?
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to go back, and I don't understand why, for guys that come, say, in my era, if, you know, you played for 4 years or you played for 5 years and you're a vested player, and, you know, for the most part, the way that it is if you play three full seasons and four games in your fourth year, you're a vested player, and your benefits, you know, really don't change unless, I think, you go over kind of 10 years or something. I don't understand why they just can't apply that to those guys. You know, whether or not the NFL was making $9 billion back then, the NFL wouldn't be making $9 billion today if it wasn't for those guys back then. So, you know, they've earned it. And, you know, it's sad when you see a lot of the current players saying, screw those guys. I don't care about them. You know, they're not, they don't have an impact on my life. I'm concerned about me, myself, and I, and I'm going to get what I can for my family. And, you know, the only, you know, the biggest thing that those guys have going for them is that they were born, you know, 30 years later than those other guys. And, you know, that's it. They're not necessarily better football players. They were just born at the right time. And those guys weren't. And, you know, but as far as the impact on the game today, these guys, you can't, you know, duplicate what they did. I mean, the blue-collar effort, the kind of the tough guy attitude, ultimately that's what this league is built on, and that's because of those guys. If the players that are playing today were counted on to build the league back then, forget about it. You know, sitting out of practice because of a hangnail.
We could count on Dez Bryant. Could we count on him?
Yeah, I know. Could you imagine having to count on some of these guys? As people wouldn't have bought into that back then. No way.
Yeah. It certainly is, Jason, an emotionally charged issue and a debate, and we're getting ready to wrap up our interview. I know you got to head off somewhere, but I hate to close on such a downer of a note, but in college football news, of course, this week, the autopsy report came out on Oklahoma's Austin Box, and it cited that there were 5 separate painkillers and anti-anxiety drugs in his system during the time of death. Jason, I know this hits close to home. You are someone that has lived this. You've breathed it. You've gone through this. What were your thoughts when you heard about this? And is this a widespread problem that we're seeing specifically with college football?
I think it is. I mean, I think it's more than just football players. I think it now has become an issue for all college students and high school students. And it's sad. It's sad because here's a kid that was just, you know, getting going in life. And you know, to go this way, it really is sad. But, you know, now it's scary out there. I mean, and as someone who's got 2, you know, little kids right now, to think about what life's going to be for them when they're 22 years old. And, you know, these kids have everything at their fingertips, and that's the problem. And, you know, the internet, you know, you can order all these drugs, and I don't know how he got them or where he got them, but all these drugs, you can log on to those online pharmacies, and some of them are legit, but there's a lot that aren't. And if you're creative enough, and most of these kids are nowadays, I mean, you know, they know their way around the internet and the web. I mean, you know, my idea of a computer back when I was, you know, not their age, but when I was in high school, it was a Commodore 64. I mean, you know, the floppy disks they had to stick in.
Yeah.
You know, there was no internet. I mean, and I still, you know, my younger friends that I have, they laugh because I don't ever call it the internet or the web. I'm like, you can get that on the computer. I can find that on the computer.
Yeah.
You know, that's how I refer to it. And, but now, you know, these kids are learning their way around the web. You know, when they're basically out of diapers, and you know, the classes, they all take computer classes now, you know, in grade school and up through high school, and we never had to do that. So, you know, these kids, they can find anything and learn how to do something all at the flick of a couple fingers. It's sad because I know it's not just at Oklahoma. You know, it's
University of Alabama, we saw it with Aaron Douglas.
Yeah, the kid who transferred from Tennessee to Alabama. I mean, you know, at a spring break party or something like that, and next thing you know, he's dead out on the deck area. I mean, it's crazy. I don't know if it's just, I'm sure part of it is lack of knowledge. You know, for as much information as these kids can get, they don't want to look at the other side of things. They don't want to know the side effects and what can actually happen if something goes wrong. They just, you know, want to hear what they want to hear. And so it's scary. And it's something that I think the NCAA needs to do a better job of educating these guys. You know, I don't think they do anything more now than when I was back at school, and that's pretty much nothing. It's up to, I think, your athletic director, your head coach, as to, are we going to bring in somebody to talk to these guys? I mean, the NCAA may send one guy around each year, and he may give a little 20-minute, you know, lecture on, you know, drugs and but it's probably more about what's going to happen to you if you use drugs by the NCAA. You know, you're going to be suspended. You're going to be this. You're going to be that. Not you're going to lose your life like Austin Box did. So they need to step up their game, and so do the individual universities. I think they all should, I think, commit more time and money and effort into making sure that these kids know exactly what they're doing. And that are educated on some of these decisions that they make.
It certainly is an issue that definitely has to be addressed. Jason, listen, thank you so much for stopping by. We kept you long. You provided some great information, and we look forward to catching up with you next week, as always.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Go get some sleep. We're going to step aside. Much more straight ahead this weekend on the Big E Sports Show.